Welcome to Warm Jewel Temple. I have an old story and a new story. Which would you like to hear?
New story?
Both. Well, fortunately, they're the same.
Trick question.
It's an old Zen story, but it's never been told quite like this before. So it's very new. This is case 23 in the Book of Serenity. Lutsu faces the wall. And the story goes like this. Whenever Lutsu, who was an old, new Zen teacher, whenever Lutsu saw a monk coming to talk to him or ask a question or say something or even just to shake his hand, whenever Lutsu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. One time, Lutsu's Dharma brother, Nan Chuan, heard about this. And Nan Chuan said, "Well, I always tell people to realize directly before the empty eon, to understand before Buddhas appear in the world. But still, I haven't found even one person, not even a half person." Lutsu will go on this way till the year of the donkey. In the Chinese zodiac, each year has an animal, and there is no donkey in the Chinese zodiac. So, Lutsu and his Dharma brother Nan Chuan were both disciples of Matsu, the great Zen teacher Matsu, who coined many well-known Zen phrases, such as, "Mind itself is Buddha." That was a good one. And we also have the story of Bodhidharma, a Zen founder in China who had some conversation with the Emperor of China when he first arrived in the country, and the Emperor didn't understand, so Bodhidharma just went and faced the wall for 9 years as a way to kind of help elucidate his teaching for the Emperor and everyone else. I think an important word in the story for me seems to be immediately. When a monk came, Lutsu immediately faced the wall. So immediately means like, not like quickly. Quickly would be way too slow. Right. He immediately faced the wall. And I'm not sure what that word is in Chinese, but in my teacher's commentary on this story, he also picked up on the word immediately in English and said, immediately is like without mediation, or without a medium through which to pass, immediately. So it seems to me that's like immediately is not even quick, it's like immediately. So there isn't time to, for example, uncross one's legs and turn around on the cushion and face the wall, or even there's a kind of Japanese style of getting on the sitting platform, where you sit on the platform facing out like that, and the monks will often cross their legs, and then they'll spin with crossed legs to face the wall. So it seems a little bit awkward, and seeing some of the Japanese priests will do this, and I haven't seen anybody around here doing it quite like that. But maybe that would be a way, if you could flip your legs into a cross-legged position and then just like take a deep breath and you just spin quickly. But that would be way too slow for immediately facing the wall. So I don't think there's enough time to turn around the other direction and immediately. So this kind of facing the wall would have to be without even moving a particle. Lutsu, face the wall. What is this wall that Bodhidharma faced? And like, this wall seems to have windows in it. It seems to have a person or so, and kind of superimposed on it. And when all those things come at us, we can face those things, or we can just face the whole wall without fixating on a window or a doorknob or something happening on the wall, just facing the wall directly and immediately. Which doesn't mean that Lutsu then didn't see the monk, didn't interact with the monk, but he immediately faced the wall. When a monk came and I imagine just when anything happened. So this practice may be possible to, when anything is happening, to immediately face the wall. Because when anything is happening and we resist it. Have you ever resisted anything that was happening? I sometimes do that myself. I would propose that resisting what is coming towards us is another name for the illusion of a separate self. Not even so much that the illusion of a separate self is the cause for resistance. Tonight I would propose even that what we call the separate self, you know, we hear about this in the Buddha's teachings, that there isn't really a separate independent self, but we often think or feel as if there is one and act from such a such an illusion. Could it be that this illusion of the separate self is actually just resistance to what's happening? That's all it is. And another name for resistance to what's happening is discontent, suffering. So that's a kind of maybe Buddhism in a nutshell. Is this three-part equation. Resistance to what's happening equals the illusion of a separate self, equals discontent and an absence of joy. So sometimes when things are coming in a way that's like changing, we resist the change, and sometimes when things are going along quite nicely the way we like, a way that we don't like, then when it changes, we're actually quite content with that, and we resist the non-change. So sometimes we resist things changing, right? And sometimes we resist things staying the same. And I think we all have both types, but maybe there's kind of different karmic tendencies, different personality types around liking a lot of dynamic change versus liking a lot of stability and non-change. I don't know if this is true, that people fall into these categories. Sometimes it seems like there are these different types of people. Some really can't stand just sitting still because they really like a lot of change, and some can't stand moving because they like a lot of stillness. And I think if there are these different types of people, I myself would fall into the category of liking a lot of stillness. Of course, we all like change sometimes, but I like a lot of stability and settledness. That's maybe partly why I got into Zen practice. Maybe some people get into Zen practice because it's like you really get to notice how everything's constantly changing and impermanent. At any rate, I have that kind of tendency, so my dear wife Shoho is house sitting for a few weeks recently out of town, and so during that time I got to really do the kind of bachelor kind of life, which I'm very familiar with and is very, very comfortable for me, because I can just like do my own thing. which mostly involves a lot of like leaving everything kind of the way it is. A lot of stillness. She likes a little more activity and dynamism. So I had a little more maybe stillness than usual, and I really settled into this, my routine, very comfortable. And then she came back and kind of energized from this time away and wanted to completely change our living quarters. Not just, you know, occasionally she has before wanted to like move a couple pieces of furniture. This was not like that. This was like move every piece of furniture, like completely, like, to the other side of the rooms and backwards and upside down. It was a creative vision, an inspired impulse. I think she'd even been planning this a while during her time away house sitting. When I get back, I'm going to start something really new and different. And she even warned me, I think, before she came. And I said, well, let's not do it right away. We can wait a few days, right? And maybe not change too much. And like started, drawing little maps and like, whoa, this is... She's like, you're serious here, aren't you? So at some point I was like, it took me a while to warm up to it. And a lot of things, when I first hear about something changing, my first impulse is to just resist it. Just because, like, I like this. Things to stay the same. And therefore, that's called the sense of a separate self, sense of an independent self arising and saying, I'm identified with things the way they are here, and it might have some problems, but at least it's familiar. I like familiar. And also, this is called discontent. When I actually would like things to stay the same, but I can see it's not going to go that way. This is, by the way, a great practice benefit of marriage.
I was going to say, yeah, how's it going for you?
Yeah. It's good to not be able to make up everything my own. So, let's try it. Let's start moving things around. So we started and it was okay. But, I noticed that the more, and of course, partly moving everything, we haven't moved everything around for like 6 years in there. So there's, you know, layers of dust and there's layers of papers and just like endless like saved junk that, that needed to be sorted through. It's, you couldn't just like pick it all up and put it back. It wouldn't be quite right on the other side of the room, right? Kind of like, this stuff is like, I've been avoiding because I like to like leave it the way it is. So it's kind of like I have to face all of it. I have to face all these changes, to face all this like heaps of karmic sludge in the forms of like little scraps of paper with very important things written on them that I haven't seen for 6 years. So at some point in this process, I was resisting it more and more, feeling more and more disoriented. It was disorienting. For someone with this kind of karmic tendency, she was having a lot of fun, but, and I, at some point I was like, just had to confess, this is just really hard and disorienting and I don't like it. And in theory, it was kind of okay, but I could just see the resistance. And then there's this phenomena, I think especially a special kind of sickness that Zen practitioners can catch. I don't know if any of you have had this sickness, it's called resistance to resistance. Because Zen practitioners, good Zen practitioners, should not resist things, right? Yeah. They shouldn't have a problem with anything changing or with anything staying the same. So I could see I was having more and more of a problem and I didn't like having such a problem. So that like, you know, just like put, you know, lumped problem onto problem. And at some point, there seemed to be no alternative but to just face the wall of what was happening. What's happening is always like a wall. And maybe in, partly where we get caught is when we're into the particulars, like, And this kind of like moving everything around is an interesting thing because you can really fixate on particulars. Like we can move everything around except this one little thing on the shelf here. That one can't go. That's like sacred. Like that. But she's got another idea. No, that's one of the main things we really do have to move. You can really get into this one little thing. It's like kind of missing the wall for the windows. The doorknob, we're like not facing the wall, we're facing like a little screw in the door or something. And so facing the wall is kind of like, in a way, like kind of stepping back and seeing the bigger picture of the whole wall. There's just one wall to face. It's like an all-inclusive wall, and it includes all the doorknobs and screws and windows and people and situations and thoughts and feelings. All that doesn't go anywhere, but it's like the wall is like the whole surface, boundless wall, 10,000 miles high, as they sometimes say in Zen. What is it? So high, you can't get over it. So low, you can't get under it. So wide, you can't get around it. Gotta go through the gate, the Dharma gate of facing the wall. directly. Which, and the nice thing about this Dharma gate of facing the wall is that it only really works when it's immediate. If it's like, I think I'll like slowly turn around and face the wall, just becomes more doorknobs and screws and stuff. It's more like without changing anything, without any manipulation, one of our ancestors says, turning away and touching are both wrong. So turning, like trying to slowly turn away the other direction from the wall is not quite right. And to kind of just like get a hold of the wall and touch it is not quite right. Just facing the wall directly and immediately is a great relief. And it's where what seems like the most solid, well-constructed, cumbersome, heavy, constricted, separate self can immediately reveal itself to be the wall. Not like a kind of a gradual process. So things are happening all the time, and they're coming. All these monks are coming. All these situations are coming. And so when we see them coming, can we immediately face the wall? And then Lu Tzu's Dharma brother, Nan Chuan, said, well, when he heard about this Lu Tzu facing the wall, he said, I always teach them to directly realize before the empty eon. So in these kalpas, these long cycles of change and arising and abiding and disintegration at the end of the eon of destruction and disintegration, there's this empty eon in Buddhist cosmology, or the eon of emptiness, where nothing's happening. When one eon has ceased and the next one hasn't yet arisen, there's an eon of emptiness. And so Lu Tzu, or Nan Chuan, says, I always teach people to realize directly before the arising of this eon of emptiness. So before any time. And to understand before the Buddhas appear in the world. Which sounds to me very similar to facing the wall immediately. But that's how Lu Tzu's brother, Nan Chuan, put it. And he said, even though I teach this way, I still haven't found even one person or even a half. I think this is like a teacher looking for the one who can practice that way. And Nan Chuan's most well-known disciple was Zhao Zhou. The great Zhao Zhou, one of the great Zen ancestors of all time. And so what about him? Was he a person or a half a person? Well, Nan Chuan just said, in this playful Zen language that they used in the old days and sometimes the new days, Nan Chuan just said, well, I haven't found a person. I haven't even found a half a person who realizes before the empty eon. Of course not. Yeah, and then Nanchuan said, well, Lutsu will go on this way, facing the wall, until the ear of the donkey. So you can hear these things often as like criticism, sort of bantering criticism, but often what sounds that way at first we see is really these dear Dharma friends praising each other. That's how I hear it, and most of the commentators also understand this as great joyful praise of Nanchuan's friend Lutsu. Change is challenging, and sometimes no change is challenging. And, you know, part of the added resistance for me in this case was resisting the fact that I was resisting, and also resisting how petty, actually, my resistance was. Because, like, I'm having a big problem with, like, changing around the furniture in this house. Like, I have a house to live in, right? It's like, what do I have to complain about? And all the stuff is, it's not like getting rid of everything either. It's just rearranging it. And in fact, now that it's rearranged, it's beautiful. I totally appreciate it. In fact, if now Shoho said, let's move it back the way it was, I would totally resist it. In fact, I think really, that's the irony of these things, right? No, I will, thank you. I mean, partly I resist it just because it's another change. Like, I'm, after a day, this was yesterday, I think. After a day, I'm already totally used to the new arrangement, and it's just fine. In fact, it probably is kind of better than the way it was. It's almost like we find a new identity. I think we identify with our spaces. And I'm a very, like, visual and spatially oriented person. So that's why, like, moving the furniture is a big thing. And another example of this was years ago at Tassajara, when I arrived at Tassajara with some dreadlocks and wearing tie-dyes and dreadlocks and a long beard. And lived and practiced that way for a couple of years at Tassajara. And at some point, I was going down this track of, like, priest ordination. And, you know, the Zen priests, they lose their dreadlocks and beards and tie-dyes. So I could see that that was coming. I was sort of like, it was sort of, I was on the track, and I knew that that would have to happen sometime, and it was huge for me. Because it was my identity, right? Which I think maybe is partly with the Buddha's shaving the head thing. Was we hair is kind of something we hold identity in, so you can't style it anymore if you don't have any. So anyway, I was really resisting this idea, even though I knew I was choosing to have it happen, and I thought, I'm not going to do it unless I somehow get in a situation where I can't get out of it. So I started, like, telling a bunch of my friends, on this day I'm going to cut my hair. And so I knew that, like, if I told enough people and then I didn't do it, they're like, well, what happened? I sort of, the peer pressure would force me. So anyway, I told people, and the day came, like, I just got to do it. And it was, I remember the feeling was, like, you know, really, like, actually kind of terrifying. And then I buzzed it off, and I looked completely different. And after, like, a day, I was, like, totally comfortable in this kind of new identity. And I could see that this kind of shift. Maybe the first day of no hair, and I look in the mirror and, like, who's that? That was the disorienting part, and it was uncomfortable because the identity had shifted. But then after, it doesn't take long, that's what's so surprising, is I had this new identity that I could get really into. Now I'm like kind of like Zen guy. Hairless Zen guy. and how quickly that we like start to identify with a new kind of appearance and image. It's just amazing. We're very adaptable creatures, I think, in this way. Another story about change as practice, you know, change comes all the time, but as practitioners, we can settle into our routines and kind of identified ways of doing things. So life will keep changing things, of course, and wives will keep changing things. But the story that when I heard it, I was really moved about Long Chenpa, great 14th century Tibetan teacher, one of the great, maybe the greatest teacher of the great perfection tradition. He, in his 20s, he, after practicing with many teachers, finally found his true teacher, and this teacher, Kumaraja. His style was to, he had like about 70 students, like a community of about 70 students, but it was nomadic community. And it was like intentionally so that no one would get too attached to any furniture arrangements. So it was like, and I think that this is not that uncommon. He wasn't maybe the only one who did this in a Buddhist community in Tibet, to have basically all these 70 people living in tents, big, probably yurts and tents, group tents. And they would set up camp, and I think in the old days, and I think still Tibet, there's just vast expanses of just, you know, empty land. Maybe in those days wasn't owned by anyone, so you could just camp wherever. And it probably had to be kind of near a town to find some food. But they would set up camp. They would just be practicing in kind of sort of retreat mode, all this group practice and solitary practice. And then every month, they'd have to pack all the tents up, all the kitchens, all the toilets, pack it all up and just move somewhere else just for the sake of moving and set up camp again. So just when things got really kind of settled and everyone was kind of comfortable in the new beautiful spot, okay, time to go. Every month for years they would do this. And then these just, you know, amazing teachings about directly facing the wall were just like offered and received and practiced in this context of constant change. And Long Chenpa himself apparently just had his traveling bag, and he had the people had to travel light. So the bag was both a mattress and a blanket, because he wrapped himself, took some things out of the bag and wrapped himself in the bag and to camp. And food, I think, was scarce for 70 people just coming into a random little village. It was probably a little bit a strain on the local economy. So these days practice is easy. When we think that it's so hard, right? I think of that when it's like moving the furniture around. What about Long Chenpa with his blanket bag and not being able to settle anywhere? And for some people who were like maybe always on the road, right? Always, there are people who I think thrive in constant change. For them, maybe the real challenge is to really settle in one place for a while and not go anywhere. That's a kind of facing the wall of what's coming. So simple, is facing the wall directly, the undifferentiated one wall. The verse on this story has a line, something like, when you make carvings in jade, it ruins the purity of jade. and yet a pearl in a crevice at the bottom of the ocean just shines by itself and attracts the pearl divers without having to do anything at all. No special embellishments. Any comments, questions about facing the wall of change? Yes?
I was reminded of a teacher of mine who used to talk about the practice of, you know, kind of moment-by-moment practice of saying, avoiding relationship.
Ah, yes.
And essentially that's the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was his practice.
That's a good one. Yeah. Asking, yeah, am I avoiding relationship? And relationship is relating to anything that's happening.
Right, and not being separate.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because there is only
relationship. There is only relationship, yeah. We could say that's another name for the wall. It's the inconceivable only relationship. Yeah. Facing the constant change, which in itself is totally unchanging. This wall is unchanging. Yes.
Well, I'm really intrigued by thinking about wall and the way you're offering, and I'm just trying to jive that with, like, for example, wall as obstruction.
Yeah.
You know how Red Pine says, you know, the walls of the mind, yeah, the obstructions of the mind, yeah, we're trying to release or dissolve or something, not get caught by the obstructions, and he calls that a wall. So it's a very different understanding.
Yeah, yeah.
And certainly wall can have many meanings, but it's like the opposite meaning.
It's like the opposite meaning, and which is a nice point, that when we face the obstructions of the mind, the walls that seem to separate us, the walls of like fixed, unmoving views, these types of walls, when we immediately face them directly, then they come together, and we see that those walls are actually the wall, the unmoving, unchanging wall of suchness, when we see it directly. And face it immediately. I think this is the problem. When we
face it. Okay, it's almost like that's the part that's more important than the word wall.
Yeah.
The immediately facing is the activity.
Facing, immediately facing. Right. And why do we call it the wall? Because, yeah, it is kind of counterintuitive. Right? But Zen is... That's part of the beauty of Zen, I think, is that instead of saying facing empty space, we might say that sometimes. In this case, it's facing the wall. And maybe it's because this empty space that we're really facing is sometimes takes the form of coming at us so strongly and bluntly that it's emphasizing that the unchanging, boundless, seamlessness of wall, but also the kind of affront of how it appears as this onslaught of threatening change. Mm-hmm. It's kind of wall-like in it. Both meanings at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, yeah, it's a good question. We never got to hear whether they just started having a conversation or whether they just walked away because they felt like he wasn't there. So, what are the signs of facing the wall that those monks encountered? Did they feel like their teacher was aloof and kind of cold and distant? Or was the way that Lutsu faced the wall very like warm and open and really like meeting fully face to face while facing the wall? Yeah. And maybe whichever way Lutsu was, probably the different monks who came probably took it in different ways, interpreted it in different ways, because that's what we do. But I think it's an interesting one for practice instruction for not only facing change and facing difficult situations, but in this case, the story, it's really about facing people who come, and how is it to meet people and immediately face the wall? Like, can we practice this way? I think it's very challenging. Even though there's challenging, changing situations, I think the human meeting is maybe the hardest to directly face the wall, because it's so dynamic. Meeting humans is different from meeting furniture. It's I don't think that this directly facing the wall means like nothing is happening. It's but it may be that when we first see someone coming, first start a conversation, can we first, and I think this is quite hard, first directly, immediately face the wall as a kind of prelude to our conversation. And I think this is so hard. I mean, it's very hard for me, because we immediately just jump into the content of the conversation, like the screws and the doorknobs and the windows.
I think it's difficult to be met, too.
Yes. Yes. Totally. Yeah. Very much so. But the interesting thing is, even though it's difficult and some frightening and challenging, I think it's what in our deepest heart, that's what we all yearn for. We really want to meet everybody like directly facing the wall. But our social setups and conditioning and customs and especially the kind of like small talk sort of chatter. Nothing really wrong with that, but I think that often keeps us from meeting in this wall-like way. This is nice. And in a setting like this, sometimes it's easier to meet you like facing the wall, and for you to meet me like facing the wall. Like, we don't really have to do anything here. Not even that. No, we don't have to.
So the phrase "nothing to defend" can be seen through the wall inside, and see there's no wall out there. I mean, there's nothing to defend against.
Yeah, it's a beautiful phrase. Yeah. Nothing to defend. Again, how what a beautiful phrase, and yet a kind of frightening phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow, what if we really had nothing to defend at all? We might be like overrun, steamrollered.
Totally.
Wow. Who knows, what could happen if we really had nothing to defend. Well, that's how by remembering that, realizing and remembering that, maybe the only way we can really actually meet others with nothing to defend. Yeah.
I mean, how would it feel to be stable? You can imagine that.
Yeah. Can we?
You are the mud.
When Lutsu saw the steamroller coming, he immediately faced the wall. Yeah, the big steamroller.
One other sort of frivolous thing to say. Astrologically, you are fixed fire, and Shoho is mutable earth.
Oh. Well, that explains it.
Always does.
Yeah. When the 10,000 elements, including radium and radioactive isotopes, all are coming at us at once, what can be done? That's what Dogen quotes, a story, an old Zen story, a new Zen story, when the 10,000 things are all coming at us all at once, what can we do? And the teacher replied, don't do anything about them. Don't try to do anything about them. And then Dogen's comment is, it's because these 10,000 things coming at us are not really objects, actually. Anyway, they're not really something out there coming at us. So that's why Lutsu and Nanchuan could talk this way, because they practiced for a long time with great ancestor Ma, Ma Tzu, who over and over again taught this mind itself is Buddha. And one time a monk got really like kind of settled in that teaching, and kind of like he like started like lounging around in the furniture of mind itself is Buddha. So he asked another monk who came by to visit him in the mountains, what is our teacher Matsu teaching these days? And his friend visitor said, actually, these days, he doesn't teach mind itself as Buddha anymore. He teaches not mind, not Buddha. And this monk, whose name was Great Plum, said, well, I don't care if he teaches that now. Mind itself is Buddha. And you can go tell the old man. That's what I think. So there. That's how it is. But I mean, it's fine. He teaches not mind, not Buddha, but mind itself is Buddha. And so his friend went back and reported, you know what your old student who's camping out in the mountains there said when I told him about your new teaching? He said, he doesn't care. He says, he likes your old thing, that old worn out mind itself is Buddha. And he actually said that very confidently. And old Matsu said, ah, the great plum is ripe. It's kind of surprising, huh? Doesn't have to look any particular way to face the wall directly. When things are changing, it doesn't have to look like we have to like flow along exactly with the changes the way everybody wants us to. Or it doesn't look like we have to stay still either. It's just a matter of the plum being ripe. Anything else? There seems to be nothing else, but we know it's not really like that. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.